Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the cold snap continues as the Northeast braces for what could be the first big winter storm. Also today, after being sent away to prison for a murder he says he didn't commit, Darrell Jones is out, talking about three decades behind bars and what happens next for him.
All this stuff they call in prison reform and reentry, I reentered after 32 years, and I haven't heard from one agency to ask me if you needed a toothbrush.
Also today, the Republican tax bill signed into law will bump up many middle-class paychecks, but Evan Horowitz says tax cuts are a poor substitute for pay raises. And how feeling proud and grateful can help you keep your New Year's resolutions.
Pride has a bad rep, but what it really does is it makes people persevere on tasks that are difficult in the short term, but in the long term are great.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin today with criminal justice, or what some might call criminal injustice. What happens when a person is sent away to prison for a crime he didn't commit? That's what Darrell Jones has been saying happened to him for the past three decades. So, Darrell Jones, you spent 32 years in prison for a murder that you always claimed you didn't do. Now you're out. So, did you kill Guillermo Rodriguez?
No, of course not.
In fact, Darrell Jones says he didn't even know Guillermo Rodriguez, who was murdered in 1985 in Brockton. Last month, after a three-month review of the case, Superior Court Judge Thomas F. McGuire overturned Darrell Jones's conviction. He ruled the case was tainted by racial bias and allegations that police altered a videotaped interview with a key witness to remove exculpatory evidence. Judge McGuire learned of the racial bias on the part of the jury from reporting by WBUR's Bruce Gellerman and the New England Center for Investigative Reporting. Earlier today, I met Darrell Jones for the first time in a house outside of Boston where he's been living since he was released. He talked about adjusting to life after three decades of incarceration and about the murder of Guillermo Rodriguez back in 1985.
This is a whole nother murder. So if you start with those facts, then you can CSI the rest, then let me know. So that's what I tell people when they ask that question. If you really want to know, then Mr. Rodriguez would like you to find out.
Mr. Rodriguez, the victim,
that's right.
would like to
that's right.
yeah, would like us to find out who really killed
because
him.
Because right now, I'm his only voice. Isn't that something?
What's the strangest thing about the world today that you left 32 years ago?
Well, the strangest thing to me in the world coming out, this is the same society that tricked themselves up into a president that reminds me of a guy I met in jail. Trick answers and somebody else is fake. So when I saw society was willing to do that, and I come out here, the people appear to be incarcerated.
How so?
By what they don't know. They're all looking at their phones from the little kids on. And I'm like, they're not even seeing the world no more. We do understand in Massachusetts alone, in the last year, maybe five innocent men got out. We go to jail, and it's Commonwealth versus Darrell Jones. That means everybody's involved. And now all these guys get out like I get out, and I haven't heard one DA, one Commonwealth come out and say, well, if that's not the guy, we're going to deal with it. We're going to make sure the right person. They don't care about that. They just cared about the conviction because the Commonwealth, the people like you, weren't coming in the courtroom holding them to that, weren't coming to the courtroom in masses or calling from their homes and saying, you convicted these guys in my name. I must start needing to know what you're doing. No one else is voicing for him. Has anybody called you and said, hey, what about his concern? So everywhere I go, I'm both of our voice. I have no choice but to be, and I gladly do it because if he doesn't get no justice, I'm still not getting no justice.
Darrell, can I ask you, for 32 years in prison, sort of what you did to, I guess, keep your head above water, to stay sane, to stay normal? knowing that in your heart that you were an innocent man sent away for a murder that you didn't do. How did you manage?
Well, first, you don't manage on your own. When I went to Walpole, Walpole Prison wasn't all the fancy names it is now. The Supermax and all these prisons didn't exist. It was full of grown men. My age coming in 18, there may be of 7 of us out of 600 guys. Everybody else were grown men. There were murders going on in there. It was known for that. You could just be left there. I came in and had to acclimate into some form of animal with the animals to say, leave me alone because you just raped this guy or you just hurt that guy and he just came in as a kid. I'm just coming in the block too. I'm not leaving that way. I can't do it because I didn't do this. But on my own, I was blessed to have my partner, Dominic Williams, and my cousin Gary Hall, and a brother man by the name Mark Thomas. Collectively, they were older brothers who had a hand in the jail. Those older guys embraced me. That's how I started surviving. There is no master went in and beat everybody's story. You play your role. In there, the killers were real. Not the imitation stuff I might have saw on TV, running the street with my buddies. These guys not running around the jail saying, I didn't do it. Which is one of the biggest myths I hate. Well, everybody says that. No, they don't. I know guys that lay right back with their feet kicked up saying, yeah, and if you get in my way, I'll do something tomorrow too, right in this jail. Stop saying everybody says that. They don't.
So some of the things we learned relatively recently prior to you getting out was the editing of this tape of a key witness by the police. We also heard, thanks to some of the reporting done by a colleague of mine, Bruce Gellerman, of the jurors told Bruce that there were members of that jury that said, we convicted Darrell Jones because he's a black guy.
The important thing about Bruce Gellerman was that he did the work. He didn't pop up and ask me some questions and say, yeah, well, I'm looking at an innocence case. We didn't start like that. We started on, you know, well, who are you? What's going on? Let's start from scratch. We're not friends. We're not buddies. If you start off telling me you believe me, you're not doing no story for me. And he could look me in my face and said, I don't believe anything because I don't have any evidence that you didn't do it. He cracked every door possible. And he asked questions. And he got to the people that were in the world, still alive. When my old lawyer and them said they were dead and they're gone, still alive. But the juror, that was destiny. I felt like she had did what she needed to do once she spoke out for my family and for me. I knew it happened. You're hearing the DA saying, this is what they do. You hear my lawyer saying, hey, it's a Monday night, they're all out, that's what they do. It's a different society than what you come from. My lawyer says to the jury, come on, what are we doing here? God knows you're not a jury of his peers. Are people reading this case? It's all been sitting there as a transcript for 30-something years. Read the transcript. If my lawyer's telling them they're not part of me, I come from a different society, God knows you're not his peers, and they're white, well, they got him and the DA and me sitting in the chair like I'm a maximum super criminal, not even near the lawyer, I think they would start off saying, I want to get home. It's a Cuban guy and a black guy. Race is basic here now. Yeah. The thing is that she had a concern about it, and if she didn't have that concern, it would have never came out.
So the juror had that concern, and 3 decades later, she let it be known. So that says something about race in society and racism in society 3 decades ago. You're out of prison now. Tell me what you see now in this society.
I'll give you an experience that I had already. I don't want to say the experience was a race experience because I believe it can happen to anybody. So that's why I'm making the point. So I goes to a store because I'm trying to shop for myself. I'm a 50-year-old man because I've been in jail with somebody telling me what to wear all the time. In fact, I'm wearing the same color for the last 10 years, the Kermit outfit, all green. And I went to Costco's. I didn't know what Costco's was, just a big store. We went in there. Once I get all the stuff together, I go to the little counter thing, and they tell me, you can't buy that. And I go, why not? I got the money right here to buy it. You're not a part of Costco. That was my first, what do you mean I'm not a part of Costco?
You're not a member of Costco, right?
Right. And I'm saying, wow, that was the first societal hit telling me I'm not a member of society. Even though I just did all this time before Costco was even out here. I was doing time when Costco wasn't even known. And you're telling me I'm not a member. You're reminding me of prison. They tell you that every day. You just told me that I just came out in your name. Commonwealth versus me is them too. And I wanted to tell the Costco management I should be a member instantaneously or sign up right now because I just did all this time for something I didn't do. And I'm coming to give you my money that I don't even really have. And you're telling me that was the experience to me. And because it was white faces doing it, this is how we run the world. It's a membership and you're not a member. And telling me I'm not a member, I'm somebody that hasn't been a member so long. You didn't hurt me with that. You just bothered me with that.
I understand. What do you hope to do, Darrell Jones, going forward? I mean, you've had this experience. Now you're out. There might be another trial, although people who know doubt it, because it would be pretty hard to make the case against you given what we know now, what went down.
I am the one calling for the retrial.
You want the retrial.
I was the one fighting. I won a retrial. I've been fighting for 32 years to get a retrial, not to pop out, I'm innocent. They don't let you fight and do that. I'll see them in 90 days, right? I'm looking forward to that. But I know what the truth is. Mm-hmm. Now, with that said, being out, as you know, I made my videos from prison, so I've been acting in prison, building programs, you know what I mean, various things like that. Out here, some of the younger brothers that I worked with, we're doing Drive Boston.
Tell me about Drive Boston. Tell our listeners what that is.
Let me do this here. I have to do a full interview about Drive Boston. But Drive Boston is going to be my way of working with my partner, Darren Howe, to help those not just coming out of jail, but the family of those in jail, because they all are off course and they all don't have the subsidies for what they're doing in prison and families. It don't work. So that Drive Boston is down this line. And you know, I have my own job here. So I'll be working in my own house, so to speak. It's amazing, right? Yeah. The blessing that came here. Yeah. You know,
Can you describe where we are right now?
I keep it personal where I am right now because I'm not looking for that attention. I'm not interested in that.
Just say we're in a big house outside of Boston where some people have agreed to help you. Right?
More than some people, but let's just say this. The Jesuit community, which my father is a part. He didn't come and just give me love. His family didn't just pray me out of prison. The Jesuit community is big. As you know, the Pope is a Jesuit. Their spirit didn't just pray me out. Here's how I'm going to put that. And I want you to quote this forever. Maybe make this my headline. When you walk in the store, I guess they got all these scratch tickets. And I've seen people on TV win $470 million, $900 million. They don't got no scratch ticket for love. I came out and hit the love lottery, man. That's rare in the world. That ticket that I hit, you could keep all the millions. Just give me this love because I know what it's like for 32 years to be held away from family and can't get love, even though they love you because they can't get in. I know what it's like to have 15 minutes and can't talk to your grandkids. And I definitely know what it's like to lose my brother and then to lose my own son and not be able to go to their funerals because of a conviction, meaning we can't take you out of the jail for your own son. So I know, Doc, when I came out here, I hit that love lottery. When they say light, man, I'm in light.
Last question, Darrell, if I can. What does the Commonwealth owe you? What do you think? I mean, you were sent away for a crime you didn't do for 32 years. What do you want the Commonwealth to do?
The state can't do anything but go to school now. That's all the state can do. When I say go to school.
Yeah, explain that.
I master degreed what prison is, what would help it, how it would work. Because superintendents have been changing since I've been there, retiring and gone. Commissioners have gone and went. I never left, never retired, never took a day off. I'm 24 hours. Even the guard is only there from 7 to 3, then 3 to 11. I'm all day. So what I'm saying is go to school with me. Meaning I should have a right to talk to the governor about that place because he should want to know everything there is. I should be able to talk to the mayor about that place because he want to know who returning to his community and why they returning like they are. Why is your murder rate high right now? Don't think it doesn't have anything to do with prison. That's because you don't come. And you can come. You can walk in over the superintendent and see it live. Maybe catch the fight. Maybe catch the violence. Maybe catch the stabbing and see what's going on. Right? So that is what we're talking about. That is the education. I had to live and earn that and struggle to earn that and survive to earn that. My master's and PhDs in prison are more than unique. I've been there since I was 18 to 50. The government can only do one thing. Listen to me. because they're going to change governors again in May. They're not going to be acclimated to what's going on there. So that's all they could do. They haven't done anything else. They haven't even given me my property from the jail yet. You know, when you leave with money, you should leave with something in your pocket. I could have came out here to nothing. They still have the money that's mine in my account still sitting at the prison. I haven't heard from a society agency, meaning I haven't been talked to by all this stuff they call in prison reform and reentry. I reentered after 32 years, and I haven't heard from one agency to ask me if you needed a toothbrush. I got all mine from that love lottery. Only thing government can find me now is two words together that they didn't want to understand. I had to grow into knowing as well. In hell, I'm going to do the right thing.
Darrell Jones, thank you. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it as well.
And Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And I thank WBR for not just this interview, but the longevity they gave to my case and the work that Bruce Kellerman did to all the way to you.
We spoke to Darrell Jones earlier today at a home outside of Boston. The decision by Superior Court Judge Thomas F. McGuire means his 1985 murder conviction was thrown out. It's not clear if there'll be a retrial. A spokesman for the Plymouth County District Attorney says their office is reviewing the decision. You can find more information about this story, about this case, including links to Bruce Gellerman's reporting at RadioBoston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. The MBTA is recommending adding 20 extra minutes to commute times this week as below freezing temperatures continue in Boston and across much of New England. We'll get the full forecast in a few minutes. But first, let's turn to State Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Secretary Pollack. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So overall, the commute this morning seemed to go pretty smoothly on the T. Commuter ferry service from Hingham to Boston was suspended because of ice damage to a dock. The Red Line was running at lower speeds between along parts of that line. How are you feeling overall about the transit system, how it's holding up so far?
So I think we're holding up well, and a huge amount of work is going into trying to minimize disruptions that directly affect our customers. But because it's so cold out, we do want to make sure that people know, since we can't control everything, that if they leave that extra time and dress warmly accordingly, they'll be in a better position should we need to delay their commute by 5 or 10 or 15 minutes.
Right. Now, Secretary Pollack, of course, we all remember the winter of 2015 when much of the T sort of came to a standstill. Since taking office 3 years ago, the Baker administration has invested all kinds of money in the MBTA, about $100 million to help the system respond to severe weather. What are the key improvements that should make it perform better in the coming winter?
So people may remember in 2015, we actually had ice encrusting our rail lines because the third rail heaters weren't heating them up. We've got all new third rail heaters. We're not so far having any problems with rails freezing. We had problems with the traction motors on the trains breaking down. We haven't had problems with those, and we also have a great stockpile of replacement motors if we need it. So we've made a lot of changes since 2015. But hard though this may be to believe, cold is just as bad as snow. The kind of cold we've now had for a prolonged period is sort of as hard to deal with as a foot of snow is. And so, you know, things like rails breaking are almost inevitable. But just to give you an example of how hard we're working not to disrupt our commutes, we've actually had 8 rails break on the exterior parts of the rapid transit service, but only one of those required us to put our customers into shuttle buses. For the other 7, we were able to get them fixed without disrupting service.
I see. So as this cold weather continues, and it's expected to continue at least for a few more days, what's your biggest concern? Just more of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if we're running 5 or 10 minutes late, that's way better than 2015 when service was shut down for days and even weeks at a time. But because of the cold weather, we just want to make sure our customers plan for that kind of eventuality because, you know, there's just a big difference given this temperature between standing and waiting for your train for 5 minutes and standing and waiting for your train for 20 minutes.
We spoke with Raphael Mayers with the Conservation Law Foundation. He says we need to be investing even more money in the T, particularly to replace old trains and buses. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you need to invest more if the money's there?
You know, we have an entirely new Red Line fleet on order, an entirely new Orange Line fleet on order. A third of the buses are new. We are investing. The T, for the first time, has a fleet plan and the money to buy it, but you can't buy new vehicles overnight. We're still running the exact same Red and Orange Line trains we had to run in the winter of 2015, and they're 3 years older, but the new ones are on the way. There's nothing we can do to spend more that will change when those new trains arrive over the next 5 years.
All right. Well, that's State Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollock talking about improvements to the MBTA and what lies ahead amidst this current cold snap. Secretary Pollock, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about this freezing cold weather as it continues this week and what's on the way. For a closer look at the forecast, let's turn to WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, who joins us via Skype. Hi, David. How are you?
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So this has to be record-setting cold in some way, right? Isn't it? It sure feels that way.
Right. And that's the interesting thing, what you just said, in some way. You know, we haven't broken any low temperature records. So we haven't hit like minus 20, which would be the all-time low for the date. But what we have done is stayed below 20 degrees for 7 days. So we actually, this afternoon, we tied that longest stretch below 20. And, you know, that's cold stuff. Mm. The last time we did this was 100 years ago in 1918. So pretty amazing.
Wow. So what explains this? Is there some kind of big event out there with the climate that you can sort of explain this long streak of cold weather?
Yeah, so we don't want to conflate climate and weather. Yeah. But what's happened is that, and I'll try to be as specific as possible, there's basically these winds that blow around the top of the planet, and they become pretty strong in the winter, and they kind of keep most of the cold air locked up in the Arctic. And sometimes those winds relax a little bit, and the relaxing of the winds allows cold air to flop down out of the Arctic, and it happens routinely. But this year, we've had the flopping, that cold air really coming down in successive waves more than usual. So again, it happened 100 years ago. It's happened again this year. But that's why it's pretty much a relaxing of the winds up there, not letting things stay nice and tight to the drum, like when your washing machine's in the spin cycle, the clothes are tight to the drum. But when it slows down, the clothes flop. Well, the cold air is flopping out of the Arctic right now.
Interesting. So, David, I heard you last week. It might have even been on this program. And I think you were asked, so we've got this cold weather. When is it going to end? Okay. And you said, it's not clear. And here we are a week later. I'm going to ask the same question. When is it going to end?
Right. So we are going to get a break in the action a little bit, actually, during the snowstorm. So we've got a snowstorm upcoming for Thursday, and temperatures will warm up a little bit during that storm. So that's the good news. Then we get another shot of very cold Arctic air. Perhaps, in my opinion, this may be the coldest air of the entire winter. Doesn't mean that we're not going to see cold air anymore. But I think when we look back at the winter, what we're going to experience here Saturday through Sunday morning will probably be the coldest temperatures. Then we'll warm up a little bit next week and temperatures will get back towards freezing. I see another Arctic shot coming in sometime later next week. And then I think finally in the middle of the month, around the 12th, 14th, something like that, we'll actually get into maybe a prolonged January thaw where we have several days above freezing and be able to kind of thaw out a little bit. But I really think we're going to have to wait till the middle of the month to have a sustained period where we stay above 32 for many days.
All right. And give us a quick sort of snapshot of what we can expect on Thursday with this snowstorm.
Okay, so snow's going to break out in the morning, and it will continue all day long. The heaviest will be about 7 a.m. to about 7 or 8 p.m. Anywhere from 8 to 12 inches in the city of Boston, 4 to 8 inches as you get west of Route 495. So Worcester may be in that 8 to 9-inch zone, depending on which side of Worcester you're on. And then the further west you go, 2 to 5 inches, trailing down to 2 inches on towards the Berkshires. Cape Cod, the islands, they're going to be flirting with the rain snow lines, so only 2 to 4 inches there. Either side of the canal, 4 to 8 inches, depending on the exact track of the storm, and also a lot of wind. Potential for power outages, and with temperatures only around 8 to 10 degrees on Saturday and Friday falling through the teens, you definitely want to be thinking about pipes and what you would do if you lost your power. And that could be the most dangerous part of this storm. If power's out for somebody for 2 days and the temperature's at, you know, 0 to 15 degrees, that's a problem.
All right. WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joining us by Skype, telling us about all things weather-related and all things cold. Thank you, David. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Anthony. Have a great afternoon.
For more on the cold weather and how it can affect older people, let's turn now to Christine Alessandro. She's executive director at Bay Path Elder Services in Marlboro, Massachusetts. And Christine Alessandro, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So what kind of risks do these extremely cold temperatures pose for older folks in particular?
Well, when we talk about older individuals, we could talk about folks who are over the age of 60, or we could talk about folks who are over the age of, say, 85. And for folks who are much older, over the age of 85, there poses really a significant risk for folks who are out in this very cold weather. As we know, you lose fat under your skin as you age, and that makes you more susceptible to cold, so you may be getting frostbite and not realize it. Plus, when it's very cold and if there's a lot of snow and ice, people tend to stay outside, or if they do go outside, it may be to shovel their walk, and that may not be the best idea for them at this time of year.
So what do you recommend? Is it just be careful, stay inside, stay off those icy streets?
Well, definitely stay off those icy streets and have friends and neighbors check in on you. If you do have to go outside, be sure you bundle up very well, including your face. Don't forget to put on your gloves. And if you feel just the slightest sensation of cold or even warmth on your skin, be sure to get inside quickly.
Mm. Now, of course, heating is a key comfort that we have in most of our homes. But for a lot of folks, affording heating in your home can be a challenge. I mean, how are you seeing that challenge playing out, and what are you concerned about?
Well, I'm very concerned about the fact that folks with the cold spell may be using a lot of heating oil and depleting their supply very quickly. At the agency, we usually have a number of requests for folks for some type of financial assistance to assist in fuel costs, and we are not always able to meet those requests, but we try and refer out to other agencies. Generally, if folks are on some type of heating assistance, fuel assistance, that will last them the most of winter. But with the cold spell this year, I anticipate we will be seeing requests more frequently.
Mm. And is there a concern that people could just use up the sort of allotment, I guess, of fuel assistance?
Absolutely. Mm. And what happens when folks are out of their allotment, if they are on fuel assistance, they have to turn to other sources, may it be a family member or a human services or social services agency in their community.
Yeah. And what's the best resource for folks to access in case of that? A website or a number or an organization? What do you recommend?
There are a number of sources, and I recommend for older folks who are over the age of 60, if they have that need, to contact their local senior center. There's a senior center in every community in Massachusetts, and they often have a list of local resources that would be able to help out.
Yeah. Now, Christine, as executive director of Bay Path Elder Services in Marlboro, what are you seeing? I mean, are things more or less under control in terms of helping your population?
Things are more or less under control, yes. We are seeing increased requests for transportation because folks don't want to drive in the ice and snow. And we are checking on our consumers more frequently than previous because of the significant cold weather.
Yeah. Now, of course, winter's just beginning. There's lots of winter left. That could mean lots more cold weather. We know that a snowstorm is coming later this week. What's your advice for the rest of us in terms of looking out for our older neighbors?
I would suggest if you have some neighbors that you know are a bit older or younger with chronic conditions or perhaps a disability, that you check on them. And that doesn't have to be an in-person check. Just pick up the phone and call them and make sure that they're okay, that they have food, they have their medications, and most importantly, they have enough heat.
All right. Well, that's Christine Alessandro. She's the executive director at Bay Path Elder Services in Marlboro, Massachusetts, talking about the cold weather and how we should all be aware of our older neighbors and family members in this season. Christine, thanks so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Thank you so much.
And stay with us. Coming up, what the tax cut means for your paycheck and some new thinking about how to keep your New Year's resolutions. It has something to do with gratitude and compassion. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. As Americans return to work in the new year, many will soon see the results of the Republican tax plan signed into law by President Trump in their paychecks. Starting in February, typical middle-class workers should see a bump in their take-home pay of anywhere from $500 to over $1,000 a year. But Evan Horowitz, who writes the Quick Study column at the Boston Globe, says tax cuts are fine as far as they go, but he says middle-class Americans would benefit a lot more from a pay raise. He joins me now, as he does on a regular basis, to talk data and his latest column entitled Tax Cuts Are No Substitute for Pay Raises. Evan, hello.
Hello.
And thank you for coming in.
No, it's great to be here. No snow to fight with. Not too much time out in the cold.
Just the cold we hear. And there's only going to, when they start talking about it's going to soon be warming up to freezing, you know it's cold, right?
I know. I'm looking forward to a couple of days above 30 degrees, just like everybody else.
There we go. It'll happen. So, even the middle class will benefit from the Republican tax bill in 2018. What gains will the middle class see from this bill? Give us a sense.
So, I mean, there's so much opposition to this bill that I think people have lost sight of this basic fact that most people actually will see a tax break in the early years, and a non-trivial tax break, something on the order of changing their take-home pay by something like 1.5%. That's not nothing.
Right.
And the biggest reasons for that are lower tax brackets, like they've lowered the tax brackets, a bigger child tax credit for families, and also some trickle down of the corporate tax cuts. Maybe not a lot of trickle down, but some trickle down.
So you've done some numbers. So talk about the typical middle class family, what that means in terms of what they earn and what they would see extra in their paycheck.
So I don't know if it's exactly typical, but you know, one way to run the numbers just to say you earn $80,000 a year. Right now, you pay taxes amounting to about $25,000, so your take-home pay is about $55,000. Under this plan, your take-home pay will jump to, well, about $56,000. Is that a huge increase? No. People will take $1,000, I think. I would take $1,000 if offered it at no cost. But you can do a lot better than that.
Yeah.
That's the thing. So you have to hold these two ideas in your head at the same time. One, no, the plan isn't an unmitigated disaster for workers in the middle class in the beginning years. Two, there are a lot better things you could do for workers in the middle class.
Right. And the point you make in this column is that a pay raise is better because it benefits from the idea of compounding year over year, year after year. Right?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we could increase wage growth, like right now, we're in an economy that seems to be doing really well. Unemployment is extremely low. But wages aren't rising that fast. They've been rising somewhere between 2 and 2.5% a year for most people. That's not what you would expect in an economy at this stage. So if we could boost that, then you're talking not just about a gain of 1 year. You're talking about a raise this year and a slightly bigger raise next year and then another raise the year after.
So a raise on top of the raise on top of the raise.
On top of a raise.
Yeah.
And you know, just to run the numbers on it, that difference between 2.5%, which is sort of where we are, and 3.5%, which is where we should be, amounts to about $700 missing dollars every year. That's dollars you're not getting in your paycheck because wages aren't growing fast enough. And it's $700 this year, and thus $1,400 the year after, and $2,100. And that underestimates it because actually, as you say, there's also this compounding effect. So that's nice, and it builds on itself, and the tax cuts don't work like that. The tax cuts give you $1,000 that first year, which sounds like it's more than $700. Well, it is. But in that second year, it's actually less than $1,000, and the raises are $1,400. In that third year, it's less than $1,000, and the wages would have been $2,200 or $2,100. So, yeah, raises have a much bigger short, medium, and long-term impact than this tax cut's going to have.
Well, I mean, one of the arguments in favor of this restructuring of the tax codes that Republicans made is that it would sort of trickle down from the top, right, as corporate profits increase. I mean, is there evidence that that does happen?
I don't know about evidence. There's a story. There's a plausible story behind it. The plausible story works something like this. You cut taxes for corporations. That's right. That's the biggest part of this bill. We're cutting the corporate tax from 35% to 21%. And therefore, corporations have more money. Mm-hmm. And where does that money go? It's got to go somewhere. It doesn't all go into the pockets of owners. Some of it gets reinvested. Some of it will go to workers. And if it's reinvested, maybe it's reinvested in, like, I don't know, really productive things like robots. And if you have more robots around, then the workers actually get more productive. They can make more money. So there's a plausible story here. But there's not much real-world evidence for it. Most independent people who've looked at this, and I'm not talking about like, you know, left-wing think tank looks at it. I'm talking about the Penn-Wharton budget model. That's run by a guy from the George W. Bush administration. The Tax Policy Center, that's centrist folks at Brookings. They see some boost to economic growth early. So maybe a little wage growth early. But then trickling down to basically nothing. No impact on the long-term economy after a few years. And so, no, if you're not getting a big economic boost out of this, there's no trickling down. There's nothing that can trickle down.
Mm. Well, let's hear some tape here, because as we mentioned, Republicans have promised that tax cuts cuts to the corporate tax rates will lead companies to hire more workers. So here's Paul Ryan, the Republican Speaker of the House, on the Today Show after the bill was passed.
The surveys of businesses like the National Association of Manufacturers surveys would show the vast majority of businesses are going to do just what we say, reinvest in their workers, reinvest in their factories, pay people more money.
So, Evan, here's my question about that. I mean, you were talking about that before we played that cut, but it's not like we haven't been down this road before. I mean, Ronald Reagan had a big tax cut and trickle down was supposed to work. And then George W. Bush, big tax cut. I mean, can't we just look at history and say, did it work or didn't it work?
Yes, we can. And it didn't work. I mean, there is, the one reason that the modelers are finding that there won't be a big effect is precisely because they're doing what you're suggesting.
Yeah.
They look back at the empirical results and they say, well, after the 86 tax reform, was there a boost to wages? No, wages went down. For Paul Ryan to be right, you'd need sort of two factors. One, workers would have to have the power to bargain for some of these gains, mm-hmm. right? That is, employers have more money. Are they going to keep it? Are they going to distribute it? If there were more unions, if workers had more bargaining power, they could bargain for some of that. But actually, that's gotten weaker over time. The other is, you'd have to have a situation where companies felt constrained right now. Like, oh, they want to make investments, but they don't have the cash to do it. And if only they had the cash. But that's not the situation we're in. Profits are actually quite high. Companies aren't investing because they don't see investment opportunities, not because they lack for money to make these kinds of investments. So there might be a situation where this kind of tax cut would have a big stimulative impact, but it's not the situation we're in right now. Hmm. This is not a tax cut tailored to the specific problems of the American economy what year is it now? 2018.
2018, yeah. I had to think for a moment as well.
In 2018.
I was thinking, what's wrong with them? Everyone knows it's 2017. But no, 2018. So if higher paychecks are really what the middle class needs over tax cut, what needs to be done? I mean, what are the sort of one or two drivers that will get wages up, in your view?
Okay, the biggest thing, I mentioned bargaining power. That's a long-term thing.
Yeah.
If we could fix workers' bargaining power, that would make a big difference. There's really no push for that right now and no hope for it. What there is a possible hope for is for the Fed to move slowly in their effort to raise rates. We are, I think, because of this tax cut, as I said, going to see some economic stimulus this year. That's going to encourage the Fed to raise interest rates faster than they want to. But faster interest rates, that means slower economic growth. That hurts the labor market, like intentionally, because they're worried the economy is going to overheat. And that will curtail any chance of wage growth. So if you want wage growth, let the economy overheat for a little while, at least until there's some sign that it really is overheating, that there's inflation, that there's something dangerous. As long as there's no sign that anything dangerous is going on, let the economy overheat for a while. That should generate wages, better wages.
All right. Evan Horowitz writes the Quick Study column for the Boston Globe, and he joins us every other Tuesday to talk about data and other interesting things. Evan, thank you so much for
thank
coming
you.
In.
I mean, I join somebody every other Tuesday. It's nice to join you.
It's always a pleasure. Finally today, we want to say Happy New Year, everyone. And speaking of that, did you make any New Year's resolutions? Many of us did, even though we know these can be difficult promises to keep. Whether it's saving money, eating healthier, or hitting the gym more regularly, by January 8th, already 25% of our resolutions will be broken. That's according to my next guest, David DeSteno. He is a professor of psychology at Northeastern University. And he says there is a way to make keeping your resolutions easier. His tip? Well, we're going to hear about that. David DeSteno joins us now. He's here in the studio to talk more about this. And welcome. Good to meet you.
Good to see you, Anthony.
So the tip here is this connection between things like compassion and gratitude and keeping New Year's resolutions. This is really intriguing. Explain a little bit about this.
Sure. Well, if you look at most of the bestsellers on your local bookshelves, what you'll see is that they talk about trying to keep our resolutions. And in fact, keeping New Year's resolutions is kind of the problem of life in general, that is trying to reach all of our long-term goals and stick to them. The way we have to do it is to kind of have grit and force ourselves through logic and willpower,
right,
to keep to our goals. And as you just cited in those statistics, it tends not to work that well. On any given day, you know, one out of every five times we try to resist a temptation, we fail. And I think it's because we're using the wrong tools. If you think about what really motivates people, it's not trying to talk ourselves into something. It's what we feel, not what we know. And we're kind of ignoring our emotions. Sure, there are emotions that got kind of a bad rap that make us want to take the easy way out or give into a desire. But there are other emotions that make us willing to sacrifice for other people for the long term. Things like gratitude and compassion. And what we're finding is they also not only make you willing to sacrifice to help other people, but also to help your own future self.
See, this is really intriguing. So this idea, so make the connection. I mean, let's talk about a sort of typical kind of resolution. You know,
sure.
I want to, and I always think about it in terms of willpower and grit. You know, I want to get up every other day and go to the gym. I want to go at least three times a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
A good week will be four, and you know, the week that I'm aiming for is three times a week. How is sort of having gratitude, being compassionate, those sort of social emotions, mm-hmm, going to help me do that?
So let me give you an example. What we find in general is that the more often people feel these states, the more their mind is willing to value the future and to accept short-term sacrifice. So I'll give you an example. We did it with finances instead of going to the gym, but
yeah,
the same logic applies. So we'll bring people in and we'll ask them questions. You know, if would you rather have X dollars now or Y dollars in Z days, where Y is always more than X and Z varies over weeks to months. And what you'll see is most people are pretty impatient. We find on average that, you know, people, if I give you $17 now, you'll forego getting $100 in a year, even though that makes little sense unless you need that $17 to survive, given what the banks are paying.
Hmm.
If you make people feel grateful, they don't discount the value of the future as much. What they do is they value it more. And so these people who are feeling grateful, not happy, not good, but grateful or compassionate or proud, they require double the amount. It doubles their willpower. They require over $30 to give in. And what that suggests, right, it's kind of like the marshmallow test for adults. People know Walter Mischel's marshmallow test. It increases your patience. And what we find and others find is that the more often you feel grateful or compassion, gratitude or compassion in life, it's tied to better academic performance, better exercise, eating healthily, not giving into junk food, lower levels of consumerism, impulsivity, and addictive behaviors. And they're kind of like a booster shot, right? These emotions make us willing to sacrifice in the moment to forestall an immediate pleasure for some future gain.
You made reference to the marshmallow test. I'm not sure everybody,
yeah,
would know that. So explain,
yeah,
what that,
yeah,
is, because you described a sort of updated version of the marshmallow,
exactly,
test. Exactly.
Right? So this is a famous set of studies, and justifiably so, done by a psychologist named Walter Mischel in the 1970s. And he would bring children in and he would put down a marshmallow or other sweet in front of one and say, okay, you can eat this now, but I've got to go do something. If you wait 15 minutes till I get back, you can have a second. And then he watched what happened. And what you can see is some kids gobble it up and some kids can wait. And what he tied this to over time is the kids who had better self-control were able over time to have better academic performance, better financial performance as adults, all good things. And since that time, Angela Duckworth has tied grit to similar outcomes. We did the same experiment, but with cash, because most adults like cash more than marshmallows. And what we found is if you make people feel grateful, and other people have done it with pride, their patience increases. And it's not because they have more willpower. It's because they discount the value of the future less, or they value it more. And it becomes easier to persevere toward it. It's less stressful. It takes less of a toll on your body and on your well-being.
Interesting. What are the sort of evolutionary underpinnings of this thinking? I mean, why? I mean, you sort of know intuitively that it's good to be patient, it's good to save for the future,
yeah,
but is there a real sort of evolutionary logic to this?
Yeah, there is, and you're raising an important point. I mean, if you think about it, the goals we have today to max out our 401k or to complete the whole 30, didn't matter much for most of our evolutionary history. They didn't even exist, right? For millennia, what mattered was the ability to form strong cooperative relationships, people that you could count on and would count on you. To do that, you had to be a moral person. You had to be generous. You had to be compassionate and show empathy. You had to be honest. You basically had to have a good character. That's where self-control came from originally. And these are the emotions that underlie those behaviors. And so now, by feeling these emotions, yes, they make us willing to sacrifice other people by making us value the future more than the present, but they also make us willing to sacrifice for our own individual goals, things that in modern life are more tied to success. But because they're socially based, they also solve another big problem. One of the big plagues of modern life now is loneliness. If you look at the stats, you know, the number of people who say that they have at least one friend they can rely on dropped dramatically from, 80% in 1985 to 57% today. 53% of people today report that they're lonely at work. What these emotions do is they, by making us behave in ways that show care and sacrifice for others, they draw others to us. They kind of solve that dichotomy that David Brooks talks about between resume virtues, those virtues that are related to maximizing your career outcomes, and eulogy ones, those that you want to be remembered for. And so what they do is build a social network for you that will help you when you do fall. At the same time, they're helping you have more perseverance and grit.
So it's a simple idea. I mean, if you're someone who exudes gratitude, if you're compassionate with other people, people are going to be drawn to you. I mean, that's sort of the message.
They will be drawn to you, but at the same time, they are a booster shot for your own self-control.
Interesting. Yeah. It's funny because it sort of runs counter to, when you think of some examples of what it means or what it takes to be successful at work, it's this idea of being tough and sort of damn the torpedoes, move forward. Yeah. But this is sort of advocating another approach.
It is advocating another approach. And I think the problem is the approach we're taking for success in modern life is kind of exactly what you're saying. And it can lead people to kind of an atomistic, isolated existence. It's nose to the grindstone. I'm not caring about anybody else. And that takes a toll over time. There's work by a psychologist at Northwestern, Greg Miller, who looked at kids from disadvantaged backgrounds who had higher self-control and were performing better. Yes, they performed better, but exerting that level of self-control took a toll on their health. Over time, it hurt their immunity and other things.
Ah.
Whereas, because you're always in a struggle, you're trying to repress
a
desire.
And self-denial, right?
Yeah. But feeling these emotions, having compassion for yourself, working hard, yes, taking pride in your own abilities, having gratitude, they're tied to lower blood pressure, to better immunity. They're kind of a balm to the body, whereas, the stress of arguing with yourself and criticizing yourself is the opposite.
So how do we practice? I mean, what's the best way to sort of practice these social emotions like gratitude and compassion?
There are a few different ways. For gratitude, one thing that I recommend is simply doing a gratitude diary or a gratitude journal. The trick to that is, we all have the two or three things that we're immensely grateful for in life. If you think about those same things every day, they're going to lose their power. So rather, what we've found that works is simply think about things from your day. Did somebody let you in on the expressway? Did somebody stop and help you and give you directions? Did somebody hold the door for you? Those little things work just as well. For compassion, it's trying to put yourselves in other people's shoes and have empathy for them. It's also showing yourself compassion. And we've also found in other work we do is mindfulness and meditation practice is very powerful in increasing compassion. And pride, it's celebrating your own baby steps, your victories along the way, as opposed to just waiting for the end. Those types of things on a daily basis will just reinforce your ability to persevere and do it in a way that feels comfortable and energizing as opposed to critical and draining.
You have a new book coming out next week, Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. And if I understand, I haven't read it, I've read a little bit about it. You talk about how these emotions can affect not just an individual, but society as a whole, right?
Yeah. So at the end, I do. I mean, the problem of valuing the future more than the present is a problem that America is not doing very well at. I mean, we have a budget deficit that's out of control. We have crumbling infrastructure and lots of other problems. And what all these stem from is a refusal to do what's necessary in the moment, to sacrifice in the moment for the long term. You know, most of Congress wants to operate on the idea of not in my own fiscal term. Yes, doing these things is good, but if I do it right now, I'm going to suffer with the voters. But what we see is that, you know, I'll give you one example. You know, countries like Denmark that teach compassion and empathy as part of their early curriculum in terms of education early on show a greater willingness to sacrifice, accept sacrifices in the moment in terms of accepting energy costs to have cleaner energy, et cetera, and infrastructure than we do in the United States. And it's hard to draw a one-to-one comparison there, but given the work we're showing, we're looking at in the lab that show us that people are willing to make these sacrifices, I think fostering these emotions at a societal level will not only give us a more peaceful and ethical existence here, but will also, I think, help our policies be more future-oriented.
All right. Well, these are great words to hear, great ideas to consider as we kick off 2018. David DeStenno is a professor of psychology at Northeastern University. His new book is Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me on. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.